Excuse me. Good morning. My name is Travis Stearns. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Johnson, and I'd like 3 minutes for rebuttal. So I'd like to begin by addressing the limits of the Tulalip Tribe's authority to issue search warrants, and I think it's important to start by looking at Nevada v. Hicks, the Supreme Court case. I'm just going to read from it just briefly here. The exercise of tribal power beyond what is necessary to protect tribal self-government and to control internal relations cannot survive without express congressional delegation. So the Tulalip Tribe has tribal authority, and it comes either from its inherent sovereign authority or from federal statute. And largely that means for criminal jurisdiction, and of course beyond criminal jurisdiction, there's a number of places where they have authority, and the tribal code shows its 2.05020 that they can transaction business, do torts, property, contracting marriage and children on tribal property.
But before you go on, just sure. As a point of clarification, it's my understanding that that you're challenging the search warrant that the tribal court issued.
That's right.
Related to Mr. Johnson, but you are not challenging the search warrant that the tribal court issued for Ms. Kona.
No. Ms. Kona is a tribal member. She was prosecuted within the tribal courts. They had clear jurisdiction over Ms. Kona, and they did, in fact, sentence her to, I think it was 6 months for her role in this. So, no, absolutely not.
So as I understand it, the first thing that the detective did was, and it's not crystal clear from the record, but was to obtain a search warrant for Ms. Kona's records. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
All right. And then after that, I mean, we have LexisNexis and we have Facebook. There are other things that the detective is doing. I understand that. But
right.
At some point, he requests this search warrant, and that's what you're challenging. Because
right.
You're saying the tribal court had no authority to issue it as to a non-tribal member.
That's right.
Now, the argument below, as I understand it, was different.
The argument below was not the same. You're right. This is a jerk.
So what exactly was the argument below? That, too, is a little unclear.
Yeah, I also am a little unclear on exactly what her argument was. I think this is a jurisdictional question.
But they didn't argue that. I mean, as I understand it, below, what counsel argued was that the tribal court didn't have jurisdiction to obtain records in Texas.
Right. They were challenging the ability of the Texas court to do the search. And again, I think that the right question is this jurisdictional question, and I think jurisdictional is always something that can be raised. It's a matter of law, and I don't think you have to rely upon the record that was made below.
No, I just was trying to understand what happened.
And it is complicated. I spend a lot of time trying to decide where the flaw in the warrant fell, and where it really does fall is what is the authority of the tribal court to have warrants executed outside of its boundaries. And it's clear that for this.
Are you sure? I mean, that's what I understood to be what Judge Schindler was just talking about. In other words, can the tribal court issue a subpoena against a company that's in Texas? It's a different question from can the tribal court issue a subpoena to gather records belonging to a person who's non-Indian?
Well, of course, this is a search warrant of Mr. Johnson's private affairs, and I think that our Supreme Court has said fairly clearly that.
Well, let's just get the geography straight here. Suppose that the records that were being sought were located in Seattle.
Yeah.
So, same argument, though? Because it was Mr. Johnson was
absolutely
a non-Indian is the problem.
Absolutely. Same argument, that like any foreign nation, the tribe would need to cooperate with with that nation, with the other nation, to have the warrant executed in the first place. And so it isn't that that another power couldn't do the search if, for example, Snohomish County had, if the Detective Sally had used Snohomish County to get the warrant. I don't think that we would be here, and I don't think that there would be a jurisdictional question. It's the ability of the tribe to execute a foreign warrant outside of its clear inherent power, or the power that's been given to it statutorily through the federal government.
I don't think either side's really addressing full faith and credit, so I won't take you down that road. But assume we agree with you. Why was this error not harmless?
Well, that's a good question, because I know that there was a lot of other evidence, but I think that most of the evidence other than I believe it's Mr. Arnold's testimony, really flows from the discovery of these records and who he was. And I don't think that...
Well, that's why I asked you about the chronology, because I'm not sure it does flow. I mean, it certainly corroborated that this phone number was associated with Mr. Johnson.
I don't think you get to the Facebook evidence or the LexisNexis without first having this phone number associated with him and being able to prove that it was his phone number. I think that all you have left is the testimony of the incentivized witness. I think that it's dangerous to say that that's enough on its own.
The phone number was not also present in Ms. Kona's records?
The phone number is not associated with Mr. Johnson within any of the evidence.
But it was one of the numbers that
it's
Ms. Kona
one of a number
in proximity
numbers,
to
but
the robbery.
You've got to go through this process, I think, to get to identifying Mr. Johnson as the owner of that phone number. So you'd have this random phone number that wouldn't necessarily belong to anyone until you've been able to corroborate it through the records that they that I think that...
Didn't he put the number in Google and come up with a Facebook hit?
He did, but again, I think that that postdates the corroboration. And of course, just having the number go to, and of course I've argued that that's really not enough, that you can't just put a number into Google and just determine that that belongs to a particular person. I think that that is also a big stretch. The only way to prove that this number belongs to him is through this warrant. And otherwise, we're kind of assuming that maybe this is enough. This may be his Facebook page. And I also argue that it wasn't really enough for Detective Sally on his own to determine that that was his Facebook page. But I think that it really does come down to this warrant. And I do think that without that, all you have is the testimony of the incentivized witness. I think that that's not enough to be satisfied that this is harmless error.
May it please the Court, I'm Kathleen Weber, and I represent the State. I'll start with the harmless error argument with respect to the search warrant, and I think it's important to recognize exactly what was introduced into evidence regarding the search warrant. The only evidence that was introduced pursuant to the search warrant was...
This is the Texas warrant?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The only evidence that was introduced regarding the 509 phone number that was produced pursuant to the search warrant was testimony that certain numbers from records from that number matched up with certain numbers on Ms. Kona's records, that those calls basically corroborated that certain calls were made at certain times before and after the robbery. All the other evidence...
Well, before you go to all the other evidence, I think you're begging the question to a certain extent, because the Facebook evidence, LexisNexis evidence, the argument is the Google evidence, that none of that would have been associated with Mr. Johnson but for the search warrant. What's your answer to that?
My answer is that's just simply not true.
Why?
Well, because number one, as the court has indicated, I think to the extent the record shows that Ms. Kona's records were obtained first. And it was from Ms. Kona's records that Detective Sally found two numbers that were called several times around the time of the robbery. The first number was already known to the detective. That was Mr. Arnold's number from previous contacts he'd had with Mr. Arnold. The second number was unknown to the detective. And it was when he put the number into the Google search engine that he found the number associated with the Facebook page that had Mr. Johnson's picture and a picture of his truck, that the detective corroborated by going to Mr. Johnson's home and finding the truck.
So the argument is that Detective Sally really couldn't do that, that you can't put the number into Google and somehow get this info.
Well, that's their argument. That's not the evidence at trial. And there wasn't any evidence at trial produced that would suggest that you couldn't do that. Now,
so did defense counsel make that argument
no.
below?
Not that I recall, no.
No. I mean, so we're a little hampered because I don't believe that you've cited any to the record in your brief.
Regarding?
Anything.
Well, I did make citations to the record. In the fact section, I cited to the record regarding the officers, the officer talking about how he put the number into the Google search engine. He talked about the discussion about for the how he did the LexisNexis search. He took that number, and he had previously known Mr. Johnson's Social Security number. And when he put the number into the LexisNexis search, which was a police-authorized search engine, it came up with Mr. Johnson's name and his Social Security number. That both linked him to those numbers. So I think that that all of that evidence was introduced separate and apart from the search warrant evidence, which is why, you know, the very minimal information that was obtained through the search warrant and that was introduced through the search warrant was
So the search warrant asked for the phone records identified with the phone number?
Yes.
Without the name?
Well, the search warrant itself specifically did reference Mr. Johnson because by that time the officer had already done the LexisNexis search and had done the Google search that resulted in the Facebook page. So the officer had reason to believe that that phone number was associated with Mr. Johnson. But he was looking specifically for records to corroborate Ms. Kona's records showing that they linked up. There was also evidence from Mr. Arnold's records showing...
Show what time the calls were made.
Correct. There was also records that are not contested that were obtained from Mr. Arnold's phone number that also linked up the times between Ms. Kona's records showing them and Mr. Arnold's records showing them. And the
now,
testimony...
the fact that you're leaning pretty hard on harmless error, does that mean that you're distancing yourself from the argument that the tribe tribal court has the authority to issue subpoenas concerning the records of non-Indians?
No, I started with harmless error because I disagree with the factual assertions that were made by counsel and the arguments were made by counsel on that.
But the cases that you have cited on the jurisdictional issue are not particularly on point, are they?
Well, I think the one case that is helpful to the court actually was cited by the defense, and that is State versus Clark. And the reason why I say that is because at page 27, 178 Washington 2nd, page 27, the court there specifically says, in the context of a state's execution of criminal process in the reservation lands, this accommodation requires consideration of the jurisdiction associated with the location of the criminal act and any governing tribal criminal procedures. Well, we know that the court had jurisdiction over the crime. And I think the problem with the defendant's argument in this case is he's characterizing it as jurisdiction over the person. That's not what the court is doing when it's issuing a search warrant. The tribal court did have authority both federally through the tribal court's own laws and statewide to issue a search warrant for evidence of a crime that occurred on tribal land. And there's no contest that this crime occurred on tribal land. The authority from the federal government comes from...
Well, at that time, though, when the warrant was issued, it was focused, apparently, on Mr. Johnson.
Well, because we knew it was focused on a particular phone number, which we believed was associated with Mr. Johnson. And it was to produce additional circumstantial evidence that Mr. Johnson was involved in this robbery. That would corroborate Mr. Arnold's direct testimony that he was involved in this robbery, as well
but
as
But if
other
you did find evidence that Mr. If the tribal court did find evidence that Mr. Johnson was involved in the robbery, it could not prosecute him.
No, that's correct, but that's the difference we're talking about between personal jurisdiction and in rem jurisdiction, which is what is involved in when you're talking about issuing a search warrant. The tribal court is a magistrate under state
in rem jurisdiction, you call it, or earlier you called it jurisdiction over the crime.
Well,
those
it
don't
is
sound
over
like
the
same thing.
They are two different things, but they are all both involved in the search warrant here. And I think the court
Well, is there
has
any case that you have that says in no uncertain terms, or, you know, a little bit more clearly than I think maybe the cases that you've cited, that a tribal court has the authority to issue process, to issue a subpoena for evidence of a crime where the information submitted to the tribal court is that a non-tribal member is the person of interest, is the topic, is the suspect. The probable cause that exists, or mm-hmm. whatever it is, has to do with that person.
Yeah, I don't.
You would think there would be a case like that by now.
Well, this might be the court's opportunity to issue that case, because I don't
on
know
this
the case.
Briefing, I don't see that yet.
Yeah, I don't know the case. I haven't been able to find a case, and I don't believe the defense counsel has found a case either, or it would have been cited. What I can tell you, though, is that the tribal court does have authority under its tribal code, 1.14 and 1....
But it says to the extent of federal jurisdiction, and I'm not even sure you're citing the right code provisions.
Well, the under federal provisions, they do, you're correct. Under Tulalip Tribal Law 1.2.1 and 1.2.2, they have jurisdiction over whatever happens on tribal lands. 5.3.1 and 5.3.2 delineate the tribal court's authority to issue search warrants for crimes that occurred on tribal land. The federal authority for issuing a search warrant for process for out-of-state phone records comes from 18 U.S.C. Section 2307, which I did cite in my brief. I want to also draw the analogy.
If the evidence had been thought to reside in a home of someone who was not a tribal member and who was living off of the reservation, does the tribal court have authority to do that, to issue that search warrant? For a tribal police officer to go into Everett, let's yeah. say, and search somebody's
I'm not sure
house.
That a tribal court would have the authority to do that, simply because its jurisdiction is limited to crimes occurring on tribal land. But again, like a district court doesn't have
well,
jurisdiction.
Well, let's say that they're looking for evidence mm-hmm. Pertinent to a crime that occurred on tribal land, to this very crime, in fact.
Yes.
But the evidence is thought right. to be in somebody's house in Everett.
Yeah, they would.
Or Seattle.
Actually.
They could go to Seattle and search
yes.
a house.
Because the tribal judges are magistrates under RCW 220.010, and magistrates who do have authority to issue search warrants. So, yes, the tribal judge would have that authority. I would ask the court to affirm the defendant's conviction.
Before you sit down, I had one point of clarification as to the double jeopardy argument.
Okay.
It appears that you concede, because there was no special verdict form on the prong related to inflicting injury, that it's only the deadly weapon that mm-hmm. the jury convicted on. Is
right.
that a correct understanding?
I think we don't I don't think we know. And I think that because we don't know, because it wasn't a special verdict, that the merger doctrine would apply unless this court found that there was a separate purpose and effect for the assault. And that's that's the state's argument, is that those crimes can be punished separately because there was a
separate. Well, but do you concede that because we don't know and there was no verdict form, that we're just looking at the deadly weapon prong?
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
So I want to just start again by emphasizing that warrants require particularized suspicion and no government. And I think that this is probably why there isn't a case on this. No government gets to go out and fish. We have to have particularized suspicion. And the particularized suspicion here was upon Mr. Johnson, not on records anywhere. And I don't think that a court would uphold a warrant to just go find records. I think there has to be particularized suspicion.
Yeah, but that's not your argument. I mean, your argument is they didn't have the authority.
And that's absolutely right. But I heard otherwise, that we can sort of go out and do it.
Well, I think those were in hypothetical conversations.
Yeah, yeah. And this is not in rem. This is personal jurisdiction upon Mr. Johnson. It isn't about the property somewhere, or it's a completely different line of cases, and I really hope that we stick to Clark and Yuda and Schmuck and the other cases that talk about jurisdiction.
Well, apparently you've cited the cases that help us.
And I embrace all of those cases, because I don't think that you will find within Clark, which holds that the warrant upheld because the tribe had not regulated on that, anything that is contrary to my argument here. And of course I cited that case, and I think that the cases that help define this issue for the court is Clark, along with Yuta and Schmuck, and those cases could tell you where to go. And I totally embrace everything that Clark says, because I think that that is what the law is, and I don't think that you'll find that to be contrary to the argument.
What's the outcome in Clark? The warrant is or is not?
So Clark involves sort of a reverse search warrant, where the court holds that the warrant is upheld on tribal land because the tribe has not made has determined at that time. I think that it may have actually changed between the time of the argument and the time of the search warrant, but they had not yet determined that they should regulate their own properties, and so the warrant was upheld under those grounds. But it's sort
of a state warrant.
Yeah, it's reversed from here, but still the jurisprudence is exactly the same. That courts have limited jurisdiction, and that jurisdiction is clearly limited to the ability to that has been either given to it through its sovereign inherent power or through the federal government. I want to just finish just very briefly by just touching on a quote from the record here. They took my money out, and that's when they dropped my wallet on the ground, and that's when they bashed me upside the head.
Is this the double jeopardy?
That's the double jeopardy. And that is that's on RP 62. That's it. There's no separation in time. There's no separation in law. Same evidence, same facts. And I really think that.
So do you agree that because there was no special verdict form that we're just looking at the deadly weapon alternative?
I do. I think that the court made a lot of errors in sentencing them as too.
Well, that's later.
Yeah.
If obviously we agree with you on double jeopardy, we would not reach the sentencing issues.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.